Israel in Egypt. Commentary for the June 25th, 2022 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry. www.visitstillwaters.com. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones. Hebrews 11:22. As we close out the book of Genesis with Jacob blessing his offspring prior to his death and Joseph's eventual death at the age of 110, we close out this window on the Bronze Age as well. Then, following the collapse of much of civilization, the Mycenaean Dark Ages leave us with many mysteries about the history of the Near East and the Levant as society tries to regain its footing over the ensuing centuries. Even the Bible is silent regarding the almost apocalyptic transition to the Iron Age. Egypt regained some of its former glory under Ramses II and Ramses III, but the Hittites, the same people who sold Abraham the first land he owned in Canaan, were no longer an empire. The Assyrians were struggling to reemerge and would eventually challenge and absorb the kingdom of Israel, to leave only Judah and Jerusalem to finally be conquered by Babylon, the same kingdom that also conquered Assyria. Ironically, the Hittites during the Bronze Age had conquered Babylon, but despite their newly realized power, with the Hittites gone and Assyria defeated, Babylon would all too soon fall before what would become the Persian Empire, the ancient foundation for modern Iran. Even though we have nowhere near the knowledge we would like to have of Bronze Age civilization, every society has a desire to know where they came from and why. They believe that hidden in that elusive story are answers to their own angst about where their people might be headed. The purposes for existence are often acted out in the lives and interactions of mythological beings. The Greeks had their gods and demigods, as did the Egyptians. The Babylonians had their godlike hero kings, hearkening back to the mythology surrounding Nimrod and Semiramis. The parallels found in these mythologies reveal a deeply felt need to explain the distant past and find in that explanation a justification for exceptionality for one's own people. We may chuckle about these myths, feeling that these are the creations of primitive people who knew little better. But such myth-making continues today unabated. We see it in movies and on television. Americans make movies with American heroes. Russians make them with Russian heroes. And so it goes for country after country, perpetrating the myth of each country's exceptionalism. No one would look to any of the movies in Sylvester Stallone's Rambo series as actual documentary evidence of historical events. They recognize them for what they are, an attempt to bolster patriotism and an American identity. Many young men have willingly sacrificed their lives because of the surge of nationalism that swells within their breasts after viewing these movies. After World War II, John Wayne movies like The Sands of Iwo Jima fueled enlistments for the Korean War. The movie based on Michener's novel, The Bridges at Toko Ri, served the same purpose leading into the Vietnam era. Each generation has been fed a mythos that causes them to feel they must rise to the same standard of patriotism as their forebears to preserve their way of life. We tend not to realize that every nationality does this as a matter of self-preservation. When others do it, it is propaganda. When we do it, it is patriotism. This is no different than all the others believe as well. Why is this important? It helps us to understand a biblical account that cannot be backed up with archaeological evidence. There is an absolute dearth of support for the idea of a widespread destruction, as depicted in Exodus, Deuteronomy, and Joshua. This is despite strong incentive to distort interpretations of archaeological finds to prove such a connection. As of the current moment, there is little support for such a connection among noted archaeologists. Some would even go further, claiming that not only is the Bronze Age patriarchal period mythology, but even the story of Moses is mythology resurrected from that earlier period. There is some evidence that the earliest chapters of Genesis are a patchwork of earlier accounts that fail to harmonize on some points. While those inconsistencies have provided careers for many apologists through the ages, it is nonetheless a hoary maxim that truth is always consistent. Those apologists specialize in crafting interpretations that gloss over those inconsistencies to create an appearance of truth. Their work is a mighty endeavor because it must not only create a paradigm of truth, sometimes out of whole cloth, to make sure that not only does every part of the Bible appear consistent with every other part, thereby denying the evident conflicts, but to also do the same for the resulting dogmatic structure created based on those glosses. But as another maxim states, if you give a fellow enough rope, he will eventually hang himself. In other words, the more intricate these interpretations become, the greater the likelihood they will collapse under their own weight. Such a realization may be feeding a growing disillusionment with institutional religion that attempts to justify its existence and therefore employs legions of apologists to that end. So what is the real story of Genesis? It is found in the first words of the book, in the beginning. Just as in all creation stories, we find it impossible to conceive of something without a definable beginning. If we ask someone who makes no profession of religious belief what existed before the Big Bang, they will stumble to provide an explanation. That's because there is no explanation. It takes us into the nebulous query of wondering, what if there was no beginning? What if the process of life has no beginning or end? What if it is an infinite continuum, and since we cannot visualize eternity, we create a beginning that we can understand to maintain our sanity in the face of an infinity we cannot? In the same way, because we cannot draw infinity, we lay a figure 8 on its side and say, that's infinity. Even though we all know that isn't true, we accept the symbolism. If we look at how we describe God, we can begin to understand why the symbolism and mythology of Genesis is necessary. For instance, we say that God is omnipotent, but even a child learns to ask, could God then create a rock he couldn't move? In that question is a recognition that we cannot define omnipotence, even though we have the word as a placeholder for the concept. These same quandaries apply to omniscience, omnipresence, etc. Even the most basic concept about God, God is love, we struggle with. We spend an entire lifetime trying to figure out what love is in our own interpersonal relationships, eventually at the end, finding a glimmer of understanding, only to have it snatched from our feeble grasp by death. This highlights our problem with dealing with God. Our lives have a beginning and an end, as does every life on the planet. Nothing in all of that provides us with the tools to understand or explain God. Yet we presumptuously take it upon ourselves to do exactly that. As an ant that feels it must defend its definition of a giraffe to all other ants, we presume to defend our definition of God to all other human beings. As that ant standing on the ground cannot even see the head of the giraffe way up in the trees, but undertakes its defense, so do we with God. Out of this arises many needless conflicts because we cannot admit our limitations. Faced with these realities, it seems strange that we far more often are presented with contrived explanations why someone's view of God or any other matter is the correct one, instead of the humble acknowledgement, I don't know. It is as though it is a sin to admit ignorance. If someone were to ask us how many stars are in the night sky, would we be more likely to reply, trillions and trillions? Or would we more accurately say, I don't know? Some might ask how I can believe in God then. I have found God inexplicably speaks into my life through discrete interventions popularly called miracles. Their inexplicability is what defines them. It is God's signature defining himself, and for me, a recognizable endorsement on what he says and does. This emphasis on personal experience may seem threatening to mega corporations built on the premise that only they have the full knowledge of the truth, but the Bible itself gives evidence of it. There was no Bible when Abraham answered God's call to sacrifice Isaac. There was no Bible when Joseph stood before Pharaoh, inspired to interpret his dream. We often act as though God would not exist without the Bible, but it is the other way around. The Bible exists because humanity, confronted with the inexplicable, reached beyond its ability to understand for answers. In the vastness and temerity of that reaching, we found God, and for lack of a clearer image of him, we lent him our own. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can find other podcasts as well as the written copy of this commentary and hundreds of other commentaries at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.